Hello and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. There you can also sign up for a premium subscription, which is one way you can show your support for my work. On this episode, I talked to Maria Konnikova, a psychologist and writer. One of the things we talk about is her decision to work on her book, The Biggest Bluff, which documented her journey learning how to play poker, starting out as someone who basically knew nothing about the game. Now she regularly plays in multiple $1,000 buy-in poker tournaments, and she's sponsored by the online poker site PokerStars. Other topics Maria and I discuss include the human desire for certainty and our discomfort with ambiguity and uncertainty, our need for stories and narratives and how that relates to our desire for certainty, the importance of childhood in shaping who we become. Maria's last name is spelled K-O-N-N-I-K-O-V-A. Her website is at mariakonnikova.com, and her Twitter handle is mkonnikova. I'll read a little bit more about Maria from her site. She's the author, most recently, of The Biggest Bluff, a New York Times bestseller, one of the Times 100 Notable Books of 2020, and a finalist for the Telegraph Best Sports Writing Awards for 2021. Her previous books are the bestsellers The Confidence Game and Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Maria is a regularly contributing writer for The New Yorker, whose writing has won numerous awards. Okay, here's the talk with Maria Konnikova. It seems like the thing that ties your work together, your various projects together, is an interest in how people think and in what separates strong thinking from weak thinking. Would that be a pretty accurate summary?
I mean, I think that there are multiple threads going through my work, and oftentimes I don't know what they are until someone points them out to me, because I just kind of follow my curiosity. But certainly thinking how people think is just something that's hugely motivating to me and has been for my whole career. I mean, I think there's a reason why I decided to study psychology, to get a PhD in psychology, to dive so deeply into the human mind. And I mean, that reason is that the human mind is just so damn fascinating, right? Like, why do we do the things we do, and how can we do them better, and what happens when we mess up, and just how can we understand that? One of the things that I love is that it's just still such a mystery. We do not understand the human mind. We don't understand the human brain. We have some glimpses, but it's just, there's so much still to discover. And I love people, and I love learning about them, and I love learning what motivates them. And one of the things that I really want to do is try to make the world better, and try to make people better, try to make decisions better. And so I think understanding how people think, and you know, how they can be stronger thinkers, how they can be stronger decision makers, I think that's a big part of that.
Was there a certain point or certain moments when you were young that led you in that path? Did you have an interest from a young age in these kinds of things?
You know, it's really interesting that you ask that, because I used to say that the answer is nah, you know, I just kind of interested in people. But then there were a few people I spoke to over the years who pushed me to understand that that's maybe not altogether the case, and that maybe there were a few of those moments, just gave me a greater degree of self-insight. I think that the formative experience of my early life was that my parents left the Soviet Union. I mean, it was then the Soviet Union. I was in Russia, and were refugees in Europe for a while, and then came to the United States and got asylum here. And I came here as a foreigner, as someone who was completely different from the kids that surrounded me. I mean, we came to a town in suburban Massachusetts, like pretty wealthy, amazing school system, very WASPy. And here I am, you know, a Soviet Jew with no money, and I don't speak a word of English. And I remember just starting kindergarten and, first of all, not understanding what the hell anyone was saying, but secondly, just feeling so different from everyone else, right? They all have money. They all have these nice clothes. They all have things. You know, I have hand-me-downs. I have things that people donated to us because we don't have really money to buy me anything new. I think that that experience of not speaking the language in multiple ways, both in the literal way, in the sense of not understanding English, but also in a metaphorical way of just not understanding this culture and these people and how they communicated, led me to be much more attentive, led me to really observe people and try to figure out why they were doing what they were doing, why they were acting the way they were acting. You know, who are the popular kids? Who are the cool kids? What are they doing? How are they getting people to like them? What should I do? And I don't think that ever left me. So I think I had to become kind of this amateur psychologist sleuth person to try to make it work. And obviously, you know, I'm a little kid at this point, so I started speaking English pretty quickly. Like, I think by the end of kindergarten, I was pretty fluent because, you know, kids pick up languages very quickly. But the other stuff stayed. And by the way, like, I had to go to ESL classes, English as a second language, for multiple years. And I hated that. I mean, in retrospect, thinking back at it, my teacher was just amazing. And she was, you know, just such a saint to be teaching these kids English and all of these things. And she was just the most remarkable person. But at the time, I hated every second I spent with her because it was different, right? No one else got pulled out of class to go to ESL during, you know, kindergarten, first grade, second grade. I did. And it made me feel like I didn't really belong, like I had to do something that other people didn't have to do. And I think that kind of experience just really does mark you. And the way that I took to it or didn't take to it or however you want to phrase it, the way I learned from it was by just becoming engrossed in the human mind and what makes people work and language and words, which is obviously what I ended up doing with my life. I studied psychology and became a writer. So I think that those two things really stem from that childhood experience.
Yeah, I was just thinking about my own experiences. I mean, I've talked about my social anxieties and some mental issues I had when I was young. And I think that's related to my interest in psychology. It was just, you know, sort of like a defense thing of like figuring people out and being curious about like, well, yeah, how can I fit in? How can I relate to people? You know, I think there's definitely something there.
Absolutely. Know? I mean, childhood really shapes us, right? That's when we are the most impressionable. And, you know, Freud got a lot of shit wrong, but he got a lot right. And, you know, he was obviously a genius. And it's funny, you know, one of my favorite sentences about Freud comes from my graduate advisor, Walter Michel, who just hated a lot of his work, but you know, was a fellow Austrian Jew who grew up actually down the street from Freud. And his mom was one of Freud's patients at some point. So their lives actually overlapped. And he would tell me, you know, Freud got about half right and half wrong. And what he got right, he got so right. He was so ahead of his time, just light years ahead, genius. And what he got wrong, he got so profoundly wrong that it's not even funny. And that was such a great insight into Freud. And that is how I think about Freud. That just those words from Walter really have stayed with me. But I think that the influence of childhood, even though I think the sexual stuff he got mostly wrong, but the fact that childhood is so incredibly formative. I mean, I don't think there's a single psychologist who would argue with that.
Oh, I feel like we could spend the whole episode talking about Freud because I've read a lot of Freud and I actually have done a lot of defending of Freud in a similar way you've done there, where it's like, yes, he had some great ideas and yes, he got a lot wrong. And I'd like to, maybe one day in the future, we can have a Freud episode because
We could do a Freud podcast. I'm down. Let's do it. Look.
Yeah. Some of his stuff is some of my favorite writing, while I acknowledge that he got a lot wrong. Anyway, we'll get off that topic. A small note here. One of my favorite books is Existential Psychotherapy by Irvin Yalom. And that book contains, as sort of a side tangent, one of the best explanations I've read of how Freud went wrong in his thinking. basically how Freud's ego and desire for fame influenced him to arrive at overly grand and complex theories. Anyway, I just found it a really great analysis of the ego-related things that held Freud back. And because I love Yalom and that book, I wanted to throw that in there. I made a small edit of Maria and I's talk here. Maria and I talked about how young people might work towards their passions and interests, basically how we can work towards a career that we like. I moved that part of the talk towards the end. If you're someone who wonders, how can I create a career based on things I'm passionate about, you might enjoy sticking around for that part at the end. Okay, back to the talk. So one specific thing that got me interested recently in talking to you was a pretty short New Yorker piece of yours from 2013. It was called Why We Need Answers. I was actually Googling, researching about, you know, our need for certainty and such.
Yeah.
And this was something I've thought about a long time and something I view as humanity's biggest problem, this need we have for certainty and our uncomfortableness with, uncertainty. We just seem to have a really hard time living with uncertainty. And I'll read a little snippet from the start of that piece of yours. The human mind is incredibly averse to uncertainty and ambiguity. From an early age, we respond to uncertainty or lack of clarity by spontaneously generating plausible explanations. What's more, we hold on to these invented explanations as having intrinsic value of their own. Once we have them, we don't like to let them go. So can you talk a little bit about your interest in that area? And is that something you often think about and have talked about, that aspect of human thinking?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the human mind is just like a constant storytelling machine where we just make up stories about the world and about why things are the way they are and about why we are the way we are. I mean, we are just complete storytelling animals. The need for certainty is part of that. We don't do well in areas of gray and uncertainty and, well, I don't know. We're much more comfortable in, you know, A leads to B, you know, black and white. This is the label I can put on this. This is cause, this is an effect. And if you think about it, it actually, from an evolutionary standpoint, makes perfect sense, because that is how a baby would start to learn about the world. You know, I just told you that I've never taken a physics class, but the world is a physics class in some sense, right? Babies learn about cause and effect. Like, if I drop this, it's going to fall. If you go behind this, there's a point in time where I think you no longer exist, but then I start realizing that you will exist. And it's amazing. And that's why I love peekaboo so much. And the way that little kids explore the world tells you so much about how the brain works and how it's able to make sense of reality and make sense of its place in reality and figure out, oh, this is me, this is other people, this is how we interact, this is the way the world works. But now extrapolate that very physical thing to more metaphorical things and things like ideas and things like certainty about the world, but no longer, you know, are you still there when you step behind that door, but rather now, oh, what about this idea? What about this concept? What about, you know, this area of morality? What about this action? What about this? What about that? And you start seeing why our brain tries to still apply that same cause and effect, that same logical structure, that same rigidity to things where actually maybe shades of gray are the way to go. And something that, you know, I studied and part of my PhD dissertation, which was on risky decision making under uncertain and emotional conditions, is just how much we suck at probabilistic thinking and how much we suck at percentages and at just at probabilities and at seeing the world in probabilistic terms. We're horrible at it. Even statisticians mm-hmm. are horrible at it.
Not natural.
Yeah, exactly. It's just completely not natural to us. But that's where, you know, that's the realm of uncertainty, right? To say, oh, well, you know, it's 20% likely that X will happen, that I will do this, or that I'll see you here, or blah, blah, blah. No, we just want yes or no, black and white, certainty. Like, just give me an answer. Don't tell me that It's uncertain. Mm-hmm. And it's a shortcut that our brains take that, like I said, makes sense a lot of time, but mm-hmm. then doesn't make sense a lot of time. And it really leads us into trouble. And there are two things, and I've spoken for long enough, so I want to give you a chance to interrupt. But there are two things that are related here. One is this kind of need for certainty, and the other is just this desire for narrative that makes sense and that actually makes sense of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I was going to say the two things you've talked about there are two of the things I find myself thinking the most about is like this need we have for certainty, how that manifests, why it exists, and also this the narrative aspect. Like, you know, I often think that in some sense humans really are the stories we tell. Like, that's what makes us human. We tell stories about the world, we tell stories about ourselves.
Absolutely.
And in order, like you're saying, it's like to tell a story, you have to arrive at some sort of narrative. And this kind of relates to like the anxiety we can have, because having uncertainty or ambiguity or multiple narratives, you know, for your own life, it can be a stressful thing. And that's not really a natural thing. It's like we, to kind of be functional and move on, we have to kind of like form this narrative. So, and I can feel this in my own life sometimes when I experience some stressful event, I'm like, I kind of know intellectually that, you know, I can keep all these options open for what really happened, but I feel this desire to, you know, in order to move forward with my life or in order to stop dwelling on it, I have to kind of just like assign some sort of narrative to it in order to just be functional. And mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, like you say, there's a reason that these things exist and that they're evolutionarily beneficial to us to just be functional creatures.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's also something that we do subconsciously all the time and we don't realize we're doing it. One of my favorite papers in psychology is from way back when. It's from the 70s and it's called Telling More Than We Can Know. And it's by Richard Nisbett and Timothy Wilson. First of all, it's just a great title, right? Telling More Than We Can Know. But it's about these studies that they ran where people were given these problems and they couldn't solve them. And then the experimenter would do something. So one of the most famous ones, they had to basically, the only way to solve it was to use a rope as a pendulum. I won't go into the details of everything else, but they struggled and they'd, you know, walk around this room and kind of not know what was happening. And then a Confederate would come by and would just like walk by the rope and create wind and like have it swing back and forth or do something like that to suggest the solution. And then they would solve it. And then you would ask them, okay, how did you solve it? And none of them gave that as the reason. They would create these amazing narratives about how, well, you know, I saw this thing and then it made me think of a pen. And they just created stories that weren't true.
Right.
They just like created these narratives. And these were healthy patients because obviously in more recent years, we've had studies with split brain patients who just create all of these narratives.
Those things are wild.
Those are crazy.
The Gazzonica studies. I mean, those are
absolutely
some of my favorite.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah, those are amazing.
Mind-blowing.
Those are amazing. But those are split brain patients. But this is just normal brained human beings. Like,
right.
And we do this shit all the time. Every single day, we're crafting narratives like this. And then if the experimenter is like, hey, you know what? Like, maybe it had something to do with the fact that this guy walked past and hit the rope and you saw it swinging, and the people would be like, no, absolutely not. Nope.
Yeah.
That's not true.
The Gazzonica split brain, you know, it's split brain people, but those things really highlight like our confabulatory processes where we create these complex stories around why we did things or why we thought things, and they're just complete illusions.
Absolutely. So. But this Nisbett and Wilson paper, like, this is just what we do. We don't have to be split brain.
Yeah, exactly.
We just confabulate. And so in some ways, even though it's much more subtle, I think it's much more interesting.
Yeah. Humans are liars and deceivers fundamentally.
Absolutely. And we lie to ourselves all the time. And if someone points out that we're doing it, we're often going to argue with them and say, absolutely not. You're wrong. I'm right.
Well, yeah. And I think that gets into like kind of the threat thing where it's like, how dare you, you know, we can feel threatened to feel like ourselves, our fundamental ourselves, the only things we know are unreliable. So it's like that can be very discomfort producing. So we kind of can lash out in a defensive way. Yeah. A quick note here, if this topic interests you, you'd probably enjoy a previous episode, which I titled The Illusions of Self and Memory. It was a talk with psychologist Ann Wilson. Dan and I talk about the ways we can fool ourselves with distorted and untrue narratives. Okay, back to the talk. So I wanted to get into how did you get involved with poker? Could you talk a little bit about how you got into poker in a serious way? I wasn't sure if it was something you'd been doing for a while and then you started to get into it seriously or how that went.
No. I mean, I'd never played poker in my life. Not a games player. Still not a games player. Don't like games.
I don't really like them either. That's the funny thing.
And so many poker players are people who played games growing up and who love games and who love all sorts of games. And I was always that person who was like, I don't want to play this board game. Like, can you just like leave me alone and let me read a book? Mm-hmm. Right. Like I do not like games. But anyway, I grew up in a household that didn't play games. We didn't have cards. This is not something I was aware of. And I talk about this in The Biggest Bluff, which is kind of my book about this journey. So I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but I went through a really dark period of my life where I just completely lost control of everything, where just everything went wrong. You know, my health failed, deaths in the family, job loss, just everything going wrong at once, which made me want to write about luck and the role of luck in life, and also try to figure out, how do you get on top of that, right? How do you learn the difference between what you control, what you don't control? How do you maximize the decision making in those moments when you are in control? How do you prepare yourselves mentally for those moments where, the shit hits the fan and everything goes against you? And so those were just kind of the questions that were circling in my mind as I was trying to figure out, well, how do I write about this? What's the story? Like, that this is not a book. And that's how I came to poker. And I was initially given the suggestion by just a book that someone else happened to suggest I read, which was John von Neumann, The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. And that's where I really learned about poker for the first time, in a sense. Obviously, I knew that poker existed, right? I knew there was a game called poker. But the only time I'd ever seen poker being played was in the movie Rounders. Mm. Like, it wasn't ever on my radar. But when I read about game theory and I realized that this entire theory of decision making came from poker, I was like, well, what is this poker thing? And why was it so interested to one of these great minds of the 20th century? And so I just, did some searching and was like, maybe this is my book. Like, something just seemed to click. I was like, why don't I learn poker and use that journey, use that game as a way of looking at uncertainty, looking at chance, trying to figure out, how do you maximize your decision making? How do you understand the mess of probability? Mm-hmm. And von Neumann just spelled it out in a sense, saying that, if you can solve poker, you solve human decision making, and that poker is a really great model for uncertainty in life and strategic decision making. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, well, let's see. Let me try. Let me learn. And so that was the genesis of the book. And I thought, why don't I get someone really, really good, really smart to teach me? And Eric Seidel was just my first and only choice at that point, because of Rounders and a few other things coming together. And
interesting.
Yeah, no, it was just totally random. I got very lucky.
He's a New Yorker, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. Yes. He's a New Yorker. He knew who I was, he'd read my writing. Like, it actually just came together in a very natural way. But he's also a saint in allowing me to tag along with him for over a year. I don't think he realized quite what that entailed. And his entire family, his wife's a saint, like, they're all saints, because I just invaded their life in a very invasive way.
From a distance, he seems like such a nice guy. Like, if I had to pick somebody to teach me, he'd be near the top of the list myself. So, just his vibe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it all worked out, but it wasn't because I was interested in the game as such. I was interested in what the game could teach me about all of these bigger questions of decision making and chance and uncertainty and probabilistic thinking. And I didn't even know, by the way, if I would like it or not. And if I'd be good at it or not. And Eric warned me right away that even though, you know, I'd studied this stuff in graduate school and that this is something I really understood on a theoretical perspective, that didn't mean that it would translate to a practical output, that I might end up, you know, doing really poorly, and that no one, that we couldn't predict how that was going to go. So he did warn me about that. I mean, luckily it all worked out the way it did, but it was not something that going into it, it was far from certain.
Like a poker hand.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, the book would have happened even if I hated poker and sucked at poker. Like that was, it was still going
to. Oh, so you were committed to writing it no matter what.
Huh? Yeah. I sold it.
Yeah, gotcha. Oh, right. Okay. I think I remember that now. Yeah. So did you see it as a proving ground for, you know, the work you'd done, like the Sherlock Holmes book and these other works you've done about, you know, optimal thinking? Did you see it as kind of like, I'm going to take the things that I've talked about and learn and apply them to poker?
Not in the moment. In retrospect, that makes all sorts of sense. But
I'm creating that narrative, that false narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
As we go.
My work really fits into a narrative when you look at it retrospectively, but that's never how it happened, right? Like that's not what I was thinking at the time.
Were there certain things that stood out as breakthrough or aha moments as you learned poker where you were like, oh, wow, that's really an eye-opening thing I learned that opened up other areas?
Okay, well, this is going to be kind of a non-answer answer, but it's the real answer. Every single thing was an aha moment. Like, I did not know anything about the game, right? Like, I thought there were 54 cards in a deck. This is not like a fun talking point that I made up after the fact. Like, this is what happened.
Wow.
And
that's impressive.
It's just something that is... Sorry, there's just someone randomly started like doing something outside my window. Right. So now there's this horrible background noise, but I can't do anything about it. Sorry, that's New York for you.
Sounds like it died down a little bit.
But yeah, it was, you know, it's one of these things where like I did not know anything. And it just went in these waves that actually really beautifully illustrated what I know about learning. Where I remember, you know, learning the hand rankings and like learning some very, very basic things. And I would then, you know, I went to play and I was like, oh my God, I'm so good. Like, this is so easy. Like, this is it's just going to take me no time at all. And then obviously you learn a little bit more and you're like, oh shit, you know, this is harder than I thought. And then you learn more and you're like, whoa, what am I even doing? And then like, here I am today being like, I suck. You know, poker is really, really hard. I'm not a very good player. I'm just going to do my best.
It is deceptively, that's the thing about poker that makes it so profitable, is that it's deceptively simple. A quick note here, I meant to say poker is deceptively complex, but can seem simple on the surface. Back to the talk. I have a story like that when I met my wife, you know, when we first met, she was like, oh, I know a lot about poker. And then she was like, when we started talking about it, she was like, oh, I know nothing about poker. You know, it's like a lot of people think like they've played a few times with their friends. They're like, oh, you know, it's that Dunning-Kruger thing of like,
yeah,
I think I you know, I'm most of the way there to mastery kind of thing, you know. Yeah. I'm curious if you have some of this feeling. I kind of have this Dunning-Kruger thing where throughout me playing poker, you know, I go through that, you go through that curve of like, you know, a few years in feeling like you're really, really good. And like the more and more, as I've learned more and more about poker, especially getting into like the more game theory optimal things, I've kind of got this like Hamlet, like feeling of uncertainty about, you know, even the most simple spots where I'm like, why would I bet, you know, a third of the pot as opposed to, you know, a half? Or why would I, you know, bet, you know, what exactly is the meaning of these sizes, and what exactly am I doing, and how does this fit into a balanced game theory approach? And you start thinking all about the extreme complexity, and you actually start getting, you know, getting to this point where you're like, I don't really know what I'm doing or why I do the things I do. I don't know if you can relate to some of that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly feeling like I need to learn more. And there's, you know, some people ask, like, why did you keep playing poker, like, once your book was done? And, like, weren't you just done? And I was like, well, no, because the things that ended up drawing me to the game were things that it was teaching me about decision making and about thinking and about myself. And it's still doing that, right? Like, I still, like, there's still so much to crack. It's still just such a damn complicated and interesting game. why would I stop? If at any point I start feeling like, oh, this is boring, like, why am I doing this? Or this isn't interesting, or I feel like I'm stagnating or whatnot, then I'd stop that second, right? Like, that's not, writing is still what I do, but poker is also what I do. And what people, you know, the two things coexist so nicely. It's completely possible to have both careers. But poker is just, I think what interests me about poker is actually similar to the beauty of writing. Like when people ask, oh, you know, your second book must have been easier than your first, and then your third book like was easier than your second. And like, you know, it's just easy going, like smooth sailing from here on out, right? And I'm like, actually, no, like every subsequent book is harder because your goals change and your kind of the goalposts change, what you're expecting of yourself changes, and every book is different. And no, it didn't get easier. In fact, like I think every single book is more difficult, and I still find myself, even if it's not a book, it's just a magazine piece, you know, staring at a page and being like, shit, I don't think I'm going to be able to write anything. Sorry, that is the doorbell. So we're going to have to just pause for 1 second while I open the door. Yes. No idea what they just said, but I'll buzz them in. Anyway, sorry. This is the beauty of living in New York with Daniel.
Yeah, they found a loophole. Just shout an unintelligible word, and you'll let them in.
Yep. Well, I don't think there are any packages downstairs, so we're good. Anyway, let's continue.
I was going to say the probably you can relate to this. It's like the thing I've always loved about poker and about psychology. Sort of getting back to what we started with. It's like both of these things are things that will, you know, never really fully figure out. Like you could spend your whole lifetime thinking about them and always improving.
Absolutely.
And same with writing too. Like communication is like all those fields are things that can require a lifetime of learning and interest and unlocking interesting things. And so I think that's what drew me to poker, and that's what drew me to psychology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. To me, you know, those are the only things worth doing are the things that keep teaching you something new, that you keep growing while doing them, and that keep scaring you. Like I'm terrified every new writing project I take on. And honestly, to this day, I actually am terrified before every big poker tournament. Like I get or big game, you know, I don't play a lot of cash, but sometimes I'll do like a big cash game stream, right? Like,
and I was going to ask you that if you played cash, I wasn't sure if you focused.
Not typically, but sometimes I do. And those moments before sitting down, like I still get butterflies in my stomach. I still get ridiculously nervous. It's still, you know, it's still something that every single time I just feel like, oh, this is, you know, this is a new challenge. Am I going to be able to do it? And I think that's beautiful. I love when life gives you butterflies, right? Like let's live life that constantly gives us butterflies in our stomach.
Getting to that, like what is being alive or feeling alive requires some agitation of some sort, right? Like there's a fine line between agitation that feels good and agitation that feels bad sometimes.
Yep. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to throw in here?
No, just that I'm still, interestingly, and something I could not have predicted. And this just goes back to the beginning of our conversation about certainty, right? And that you just never know how life is going to turn out. Like, I never would have predicted that I'd still be in the poker world, and that it's something that would still hold my attention. But here we are. And I'm, you know, gearing up to play more live than I have in years, since pre-COVID. You know, starting next month. It's cool and it's fun, and it's not something that I would have ever thought would be in my future. And my next book is actually related to games. Talk about, you know, I don't love games, but you know, my next book is about cheating and cheating in games specifically. So it's something that's kept me close to this world. And by the way, games, not just poker, but games more broadly, you know, so obviously poker, chess, but also sports.
So kind of related to your confidence games.
Sort of, but different, yes.
Yeah, cheating, actual cheating, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That reminds me of the live games you mentioned. I was curious, did part of your interest in poker besides the, you know, the thinking and strategy aspect, were you interested in the behavior and tells aspect?
Absolutely. And, you know, I do come to it with a skepticism of just how much we can get from tells in a poker environment, because we just don't have enough of a sample size. Mm-hmm. And from knowing, you know, from coming from psychology and having studied, you know, the psychology of deception and knowing just how bad we are at spotting that and mm-hmm. how bad we are at reading people in a lot of different contexts, and having worked on The Confidence Game, which you just mentioned, which was my second book, which was about con artists. And, you know, I spent 3 years with con artists and with people who presumably study con artists and learn that just like no one knows anything, and good con mm-hmm. artists, there are no tells, right? There's nothing. Right. And so I do have that kind of skepticism there. And yet, you know, I still, obviously I'm a psychologist. Like, I think that there's such a rich area there. Human behavior means a lot, and subconscious stuff means a lot. And we do have tells, like humans are tell boxes. It's just, I think it's very different from how it's normally portrayed in the popular media when it comes to,
yeah, for sure.
When it comes to poker and tells. And I think you understand that, you know, your books on tells were actually one of the first things I read. Not literally, you know, I learned how to play poker first, but like once I learned how to play poker, and I think you do approach it from a different angle. And so I think that it's another piece of information. It's another piece of the puzzle, just like we should, you know, we should strive to use solvers and like figure out that stuff, even if we really don't want to. We should also not discount tells and not discount kind of that live arena. And that is, you know, one of my strong points is the human element, because that's what I do. That's who I am. Putting all of those caveats that I just said, you know, that's still a hugely rich area to explore. And it's much more interesting to me. And I think that it's really, really cool to have this sandbox for playing and studying humanity in this little, basically, you know, it's a poker lab, right?
There. Yeah, it is a great game for
that. Yeah, and you get to run these studies, and without running studies, and you get to kind of look at the way that people interact and look at all of these different dynamics. And
so much going on. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this has been great, Maria. Thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me. It was a really interesting conversation.
Now I'll play a part of Maria and I's talk where we talk about trying to create a career that one is interested in doing. I was going to ask you about, you know, one thing I talk about when it comes to, you know, people creating a successful career for themselves. I've sometimes talked about this, and, you know, I've talked to like a couple classes about this, is the combination of doing, you know, two or more things that you're either interested in or good at. So, you know, in your case, it'd be, you know, an interest in psychology, and also your the fact that you know, or that you're a good writer or interested in writing. And what do you think of that idea, that, you know, that the beneficial aspect of combining, you know, things we're interested in and aiming for those things?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's hard to argue with that. It's funny, you know, let's go back to my childhood after you tried to change the topic so deftly. But it actually is quite funny. Apparently, I don't remember this because, you know, I was a kid. But apparently when I was like 4 or 5 years old, I announced to the dinner table at large that I was going to be a writer when I grew up. Mm. And so that's something that I've always wanted to do. I don't remember that dinner conversation, but I do remember, you know, writing books even in kindergarten and first grade when I didn't speak English very well. I loved storytelling and I wanted to do that. And that's always what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I wanted to be a writer, never wanted to be anything else. And even when I got my PhD in psychology, when I had my interview with Walter, by the way, I just got so ridiculously lucky. I would not have a PhD in psychology if Walter hadn't been Walter, because I told him, look, I have no desire in academia. The only reason I'm doing this is because I'm fascinated by the human mind, and I just want to learn from you and work with you and explore this further, but I want to be a writer. And like, that's, you know, that's my truth. And he was like, cool, awesome. I wouldn't go into academia these days either. Academia sucks. Let's do it. And mm-hmm. most people would have, you know, that's a horrible advice to give to an aspiring grad student, to actually be truthful and say you don't want to go into academia. You know, I got very lucky that I met someone who understood exactly where I was coming from and supported it. But the other part of it was that I was very fortunate to be surrounded by people, to be surrounded by parents. You know, my mom is an incredibly strong person and someone who really encouraged me. You can think of so many immigrant Jewish parents who'd be like, oh, you know, look, you need to make a living, right? You gotta be a doctor or a lawyer. Now, it helps that my older sister is a doctor. She's an MD, PhD. So she like covered all the bases and I was okay. But to their great, great credit, my parents never said that I had to do that. They said, you know, follow your curiosity, follow what you love, because if you do that, and if you do what you want to do, as long as you really, really want to do it and you work hard at it, you're going to make money. And if you end up doing something just for the sake of doing it, and you don't, your heart's not in it, you don't care, like, you're never going to be that successful. And I think that's really, really smart advice. And they never, you know, they said, look, we don't have money. We can't support you. Like, you got to make it work on your own. And I worked multiple jobs. Like, it's not like I could make my living from writing right away. It took many years and many nights and weekends of writing on top of whatever else I was doing. But they never discouraged me. They always just said, you know, yeah, follow your passion, follow your curiosity, see where it leads, because you never know what things are going to be useful. And I think that's just such important advice. Never do something because you think it's going to be useful. Do something because it's interesting to you, because you inherently want to learn more about it. Like, I had no idea how my interests would come together. Right. I had no idea that psychology and, you know, language and all of these things would, you know, create the place where I am right now. I could never have predicted it. And it's not like I took classes in school or did things to make it more or less likely. I just kind of did followed what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think those things are easier than many people think, because there's just so many things out there to think about or do. It's like, and especially if you start combining different ideas, it's, you know, I think there's just so much room for exploration and the world's always changing. There's new technologies, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just so many different things to focus on that are fairly, you know, fairly unfocused on, basically.
Absolutely. By the way, I still remember my guidance counselor in high school. I told her that I wasn't going to take a science class my senior year. And she said that I was insane, that I was such a good student, had such a great GPA and great test scores. And, you know, I was in a prime position to get into a good school, but no good school would accept me if I didn't take science my senior year. And I said, well, you know what? I want to take a French literature elective and I want to take a creative writing elective. These were all just independent studies where I worked with different people. And like, screw this, I'm done with science. I have no interest in it. So I actually kind of regret that I've never taken a physics class in my life. That's a huge hole in my knowledge. But obviously, she was wrong, and I got into a good school, and everything worked out just fine.
That was a talk with Maria Konnikova. Her website is at mariakonnikova.com, and her Twitter is mkonnikova. A few notes about things we discussed regarding PokerTells. If you weren't already aware of my work on that, you can learn more about that at readingpokertells.com. As Maria said, it's true that there are a lot of distorted perceptions about PokerTells and their relative importance. For one thing, as I emphasize in my work, they're quite a minor part of poker. Fundamental strategy is much more important than reading tells well, in other words. And as Maria says, humans are quite bad at detecting deception. I have a podcast episode where I talk to Tim Levine about this. Tim is someone who's researched just how bad we are at detecting deception. In that episode, I talk about how most meaningful poker tells are not related to detecting deception, but more about detecting interest or lack of interest, or detecting just someone's enjoyment versus their lack of enjoyment. This is just to say that while it's true that we aren't good at detecting deception, there are a lot of meaningful tells in poker and in many other life situations. And most of this is mainly about people just not being that interested in behaving in balanced and stoic ways in various situations. If you enjoyed this episode, I've got a lot of episodes in the back catalog you'd probably enjoy. Another one that comes to mind is a talk with Stephen Heine about how we respond when our sense of meaning is threatened. I see this as very related to what Maria and I discussed regarding human discomfort with uncertainty and ambiguity. When something's stressful or even just confusing, happens in one area of our lives, it can trigger us to try to create meaning in other areas of our life. I really liked that episode, so I thought I'd mention it. And I've got quite a few episodes about poker, too. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. If you want to learn more about this podcast, go to behavior-podcast.com. I'll put links to Maria's books and a few other things that we discussed in this talk. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.